Wilford Park answering questions from Warren and Robert Park on April 26, 1984.
Well, I hope that eventually you can get a hearing aid that'll be better than the ones you have. Do you think that it would be possible to get one that has an amplifier that's in your pocket or something like that? Would that be any advantage to you?
I don't think so. I think the hearing aid I have is probably the best on the market. And I don't think there's anything that could be any better than that. I think the point is that there is nothing that'll bring back these soft sounds.
Well, what I was thinking of was the idea of having something in your pocket, which would make it easier for you to have a better quality equipment that you wouldn't have to miniaturize quite so much. If you had a little amplifier in your pocket, in your coat pocket, then you'd be able to take advantage of higher technology.
But you'd have to have these here things.
Well, they have advanced earphones that are much smaller than that. That just have a little wire coming out of the inner ear plug. There's the pretty high fidelity plugs. I don't know. It's a crazy idea, I suppose.
Well, I doubt if there anything can be done to help me very much. I think the soft sounds are typical of a complete loss of hearing for soft sounds. I don't think anything can bring it back. It isn't a matter of loudness. Now, for instance, when I'm talking to my wife,
you can't let those touch.
When I'm talking to my wife, she gets exasperated sometimes because I don't hear. And she talks louder and louder, and it doesn't help any.
I see. I think that what we're going to do is just use one microphone. This is a little better, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, the volume switch up there, if it gets too loud for you, you can always change that.
Wrap something around here.
If you want to.
You can take turns.
Well, I wanted to find out if you remembered anything more about my fall that I had long ago when I was 6 years old, when I was Jonathan's age. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that, what happened during that time, and how long I was gone from school, and how long I was unconscious, and all of this. That was the only time I've been knocked out.
How do you have to have that a certain length away, or is that all right?
This is fine.
That's okay. All right. The point is that you were not unconscious to any extent at all.
Oh?
And but I don't think you were confused at all, and there was no disturbance as far as your brain was concerned. Apparently, it didn't seem to have any.
I hope not.
But you did have a fracture in your skull, must have, because it made a little discharge from your ear.
Oh.
And that didn't cause any real trouble, and. Your head bones were soft enough that it didn't make any difference for a little crack. It healed again and was in the same position. No adjustments were necessary or anything of that. So you simply recovered quite normally without any particular trouble. And no defects or no disturbance physically or mentally, as far as I could see.
Well, wasn't it true that I was unconscious for about 4 or 5 hours?
I don't think it was that long at all.
Really?
No.
Because I remember waking up and I was in bed already with my pajamas on and all these people were standing around.
Well, you probably were. I don't know that you were unconscious, but you probably went to sleep.
Well, okay. Maybe that's what happened.
You seemed to be pretty sick for a while.
Yeah. But it didn't leave any after effects that you need to worry about at all, and I don't think it gave you any handicap.
Well, I don't expect that, but I just don't remember a whole lot about it.
Yeah.
How long was I gone from school?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe a week or something like that.
Huh. So it wasn't very long.
I don't remember whether you were at school at that time or not. Were you?
Yeah, I was in second grade.
Oh, yeah.
Or first grade, somewhere. I don't remember how old I was.
Well, I don't remember very much about it either, but I don't think there was anything significant to me. And the doctor wasn't worried about you at all.
Well, that's good. Got anything else? Memory sorts of things to report here, to ask about? It's a little complicated. There's a lot of stuff there. Mm-hmm. We have some old photos in the drawer here, though. But I just wanted to see if I could recall some of the stuff that went on back on Humboldt Avenue. I don't remember much about it. It was only 12 years that we were there, right? From 1950 to 1962?
That Humboldt Avenue, was it?
Yeah, is that how long we were there from 1950 to 1962?
That's about right.
I don't remember, but I suppose it was about that. And then we went down to Edmund Boulevard. And then you transferred to Minnehaha Academy to get your further education.
Yeah, that's right. That was for junior and senior year in high school.
Yeah.
We moved in December of 1949.
Oh, yeah.
I remember we celebrated Christmas early in Deep River that year because we were going to be moving at Christmas time.
Was that in 1949?
1949. We moved about at Christmas time.
Was that when we went to Edmund Boulevard?
No, when we moved from Ontario to Minneapolis.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was 1949 that I left the Atomic Energy Project and went to the United States. Mm-hmm. And it was the last day of the year 1949 that I crossed over it. The border.
So that's when we moved.
And I'd already bought the house at 1804 Humboldt, mm-hmm. So we had a house to move into, and our equipment was moved across the same time, and we all got together, and they unloaded it and moved it into the house that we already had bought.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you move that piano from Canada at the same time with all the rest of your furniture? Your piano?
I guess so. I don't remember getting it any other way.
Yeah. It seems to me we had a discussion about whether we could afford to move the piano or not, and then it turned out we could afford it, so we ended up moving the piano with all the other stuff.
Well, the point is that when I moved from Deep River to the United States, that the Minnesota Department of Health paid all my moving expenses. It didn't cost me anything.
Oh. So we might as well move the piano.
That was pretty convenient.
So it was a big load, and they didn't think it was going to cost that much, but they paid the whole thing anyway, because it said they would. So that's the way it was. Didn't cost me anything to move, and it didn't cost me anything to move from Ajax to Deep River, because they paid for that too.
Oh, I see.
All my moving expenses.
I guess when somebody wants you well enough, they'll pay all your expenses to get you to take the new job.
That's the way it was. They wanted me badly enough to take care of that.
I remember the brick house in Whitby. Did you own that house too?
Yes. I bought that house when we knew that we were going to Whitby, but at that time I couldn't pay for the whole house, didn't have the money to pay for it, so the fellow who sold it to me carried it as a mortgage, and that was for only a few years, 2.5 years that I worked at Ajax, and then I got this call to go to Chalk River, so I wanted to sell my house, and the man who sold it to me wanted to buy it back.
Oh.
So he had the mortgage, and I simply sold the house what I had into it, or a little bit more, I don't know, and he paid for it and canceled my mortgage and had the house. And his son and his family moved in there.
Oh.
So that's the way they took over that brick house.
That was convenient.
Convenient to them and convenient to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in Deep River, did the energy, who owned the houses there?
The houses was owned by the company. Mm-hmm. And they gave me a free house.
Oh, I see.
As well as my salary. So I didn't have to pay for a house there, but I had... I forget, but maybe I guess I paid for the utilities and some of these things.
Okay, shall we shut this off? So, then you made a separate trip to Minneapolis to look for houses, didn't you? While we were still in Deep River?
Yes, I made a trip to Minneapolis to see whether the man who headed the Department of Health for Minnesota wanted me to come over for an interview, which I did. And at that trip, he sent me to see a doctor down at the Mayo Clinic because he wanted to get another opinion who was outside of this state health department. And this was a prestigious clinic at the Mayo Clinic. So I went down there. And before I got back to Minneapolis, he'd had a telephone call from the doctor I interviewed down there. And he had told him, hire him. So I just went back and he hired me and made these arrangements to move me over there. And at the same time, I was able to I think at the same time of that trip, I made arrangements to buy the house because I carried that as a mortgage just for a while.
Did you just look?
And
did you go to a realtor, or how did you find the house?
Yeah, so I got it through a realtor, I think it was. And the funny thing about it is when I came to move in, or even before I moved in, I had to make a down payment, and I had the money in the bank in Chalk River, in Deep River, and then when I wanted to get it out, $500 or something, I don't just know what it was, the Canadian regulations wouldn't release my money, because it was wartime and wasn't allowed to take that much money out of the country.
Hmm.
So the way I solved this was to communicate with the United States representative at the Atomic Energy Project. He lived right there across the street from me, and he was a friend of mine. And of course, he was being paid Canadian money while he was there. And he had private funds of his own in the United States because he lived here for years. And I simply made arrangements to him with the transactions that he gave me a check on his for the amount of money I needed to make a down payment on my house. And in exchange, I gave him my check on my bank account. So he got it in Canadian funds, I got it in American funds. The deal was taken care of without any trouble.
Mm-hmm. Who was that? Who was this representative?
I don't remember his name just offhand now, but a very nice fellow. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you what his name is now.
Where did the Carmichaels live when we lived in Deep River? Were they the next door neighbors?
They lived close there, but I think it was across the street.
Oh.
And then after I vacated there, I don't know whether the next doctor moved in there or not, but you found out it was Carmichael's living there when you went there.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't been in touch with Deep River for a long time, so I don't know who entered the house immediately after I left.
Yeah.
what was Carmichael's job?
I don't remember exactly what his job was, but he was one of the scientists, I think. I don't just remember too much about his job. I don't think I ever knew too well.
After I wrote them, I didn't know who was living there, and I sent a card asking if we could visit the house, and they didn't answer because I didn't see the return address on my card. So we just saw the outside of the house. We didn't stop and talk to them, but later they wrote us when they found they had a return address and mentioned that their son, Dougal, was teaching at Queen's University, I think.
I guess so.
So I think he was in some scientific field.
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of them that were scientists there to start with, you know. When I lived there, on one side was Dr. John Cockcroft. He was the head of the British organization of all the British scientists from England. And you see, during the war, they didn't want to keep their scientists in England. They sent them over to Canada, where it was a lot safer for them. And they were engaged in developing this atomic bomb in part of the Manhattan Project, which of course I had nothing to do with. But the scientists were there. And after Defense Industries, I was hired as by the Defense Industries, who also had the Ajax plant. And they were the builders of the project.
The first reactor.
Yes, they built it. That is the structure and the building program. They built it according to the instructions they had. And my boss was the head man for the Defense Industries until the building was completed. And they moved out and turned everything over to the National Research Council for Canada. And this was both American scientists, not American scientists, but Canadian scientists and British scientists together were working in the National Research Council for Canada. The British people were joined with that while they were in Canada. But the top scientist was John Cockcroft from Britain, and he was the one that became the boss at the Atomic Energy Project. And my boss, I reported directly to him. And then John Cockcroft, after a year or so, was called back to England by the Queen of England. I think it was the Queen, after King George had died. And he was given the job of developing all these atomic energy plants in the whole of Great Britain. He was in charge of that. A lot of atomic energy plants in England now.
Were those plants for the purpose of generating electricity or plants for experimental purposes?
I think they were electric generators and very effective, and they've been operated for years, so well built and so safety conscious during the building. John Cockcroft was the head of the whole thing for England. And then after he had built these and the project had been so successful, and the Queen of England made him Sir John Cockcroft after he'd become famous, you see, in England. Well, when he left for England, I changed bosses again, and the man who was again over me was another British scientist by the name of Benjamin Lewis. So I was under the direction of Dr. Lewis until he went back to England also. And then I became, my boss became Dr. David Keyes, who was a professor of physics from the University of Montreal or something like that. He was transferred there, and he was the head man during those latter years when I resigned and came in.
Did all of these head men live on Beach Avenue?
Yeah.
Where did Cockcroft live? Was he in the house next to us towards the school or on the other side?
He was on the other side. Just right next to our house, but on the other side. That's the house that they built the piece of extension on that side. Mm-hmm. That Cockcroft. And on the other side was Dr. Sargent, who was a professor of physics from, I think it was a place in Montreal or Ottawa or someplace. I think he was a Canadian. And then beyond him was Dr. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. He was a, you remember perhaps his children.
I remember Judy Lawrence.
Yes. They were all there together, and we were lived right in the middle of them. And then beyond Dr. Cockcroft was Hatfield. Hatfield was in charge of all the people that worked for the, the engineers and people of that kind who were not in the scientific field. But there's a lot of technical work that they had to do.
Mm-hmm. Was this mainly for the construction phase?
Well, there was always some more housing being built all the time, and there was a lot of teamster work and a lot of hauling going in and out and all of these. I think these are all under Hatfield.
Mm-hmm. After the reactor was on stream, were all the houses, was ownership of all the houses transferred from Defense Industries to the National Research Council?
Yes, they were. Everything, both the plant and the Deep River whole project was transferred from Defense Industries to the National Research Council, and they were responsible for continuing to build residential houses. Mm-hmm. And when I left there, they were still building houses, and the church was not even started yet. Mm-hmm. And they kept right on, you see. And I think I don't know, but maybe it's still under the National Research Council. I have no idea. Because mm-hmm. after I left there, it had very little contact with it.
Well, when Defense Industries was done, were a lot of people then hired by the National Research Council to continue with work there?
I think most of them just stayed there and were serving the National Research Council, same as I was.
Oh, were you working for the National Research Council?
I guess I was, because Dr. Keyes was my boss, and he was working for the National Research Council. Mm-hmm. And all of the doctors and nurses I hired, they all remained there. There's no change. Mm-hmm. Everything was the same. We got paid just the same, but we didn't know where it came from particularly.
How did your job come to an end there?
Well, I arranged to come to the United States. I got this job offered to me by the at the Minnesota Department of Health. And after I had consented to take that job, I resigned over there to be effective the end of the year. And that was all there was to it.
But you could have stayed on in Deep River?
Well, I guess it was time for me to change there, and I was my work was pretty well done there. Mm-hmm. You see, I had already established a very effective health service at the hospital and served all the village people. They were all functioning well, and the same down for the plant. They all had their services there, and they were all functioning well. And I didn't know in a way that my work was pretty much done there, because my work seemed to be of the kind in which I was developing and making things and getting things going right, and it seems as if it was an opportune time to move.
But you weren't hired just as someone to be hired for the setup phase. It wasn't a temporary job like that.
No.
It was your feeling that it was time to go on to something new.
So when I had made my arrangements to work for the state of Minnesota, I simply put in my resignation, which was effected at the end of the year. I don't know, maybe it was in a month or two before that, so that they had arranged, I think, to get a replacement, and everything exchanged wasn't any trouble. So I came right over to the United States, and when I came, I found that I was in a new field of work that I could not possibly find anywhere in Canada. And I didn't know, but what, well, even at the start, I didn't know, but I found out right away I was dragged into a whole lot of things. Well, even within a week, I think that they had put me on the staff at the University of Minnesota to be a lecturer, and there was a program coming up that was scheduled to teach industrial health, and I was the man that knew all about it, and I'm the one that was pushed right into being a teacher. So I taught this course. And then I began writing, and I began working with the you see, the state of Minnesota already had an industrial health program. They had engineers that were on working in this, but they had no doctor. And it was set up to be handled by a doctor. And they've been looking for the right kind of doctor for 4 years, couldn't find any. So when they got a hold of me, they were all set, and I was glad to be there, and then they pushed me into a lot of different things, directing their program, working with their engineers and people that knew something already about industrial health, but they were not doctors. And I'd already began to learn it in Ajax and learn more about it in administration and working with people. And so it just sort of come natural to be developing this program. And that's where I have this all written up in my autobiography. And it comes in I have it as I told you a while ago, that my subject in one of my sections was occupational health in Canada. And then when I changed over to the United States, then I have another section of occupational health in the United States, occupational medicine in the United States. And that went on for 2.5 years, something like that, when I was working for the state of Minnesota. And then a funny thing happened. The state legislature passed a law that temporary employees working for this for the state government had to be either put on permanent employment after 2 sessions of temporary employment or discharged. Hired or discharged after 2 trial runs on temporary employment. Well, that caught me right in the middle, for the very good reason that they wanted to keep me on their staff, and they had to hire me on a temporary employment because I was a non-citizen. It was not possible for the state to hire an alien on permanent employment.
Uh-huh.
So, although it wasn't aimed at me, I was out of a job. So we just simply I was out of a job with the state health department, but transferred to the city of Minneapolis health department, taken on immediately, never lost an hour, and simply worked in a different, for a different place, but the money that paid my salary still came from the state, because they had the money to pay me and couldn't keep me, and they wanted me to be on the job. They simply transferred the money to the city health department, and they paid their money over to me. And so I had a job all the time, and the city didn't have to be involved in the law for the state. So the city of Minneapolis kept repeating me on temporary employment as long as they wanted to. Just a short session, one after the other. I think it actually worked out for about every 3 months they had to. They couldn't renew the temporary employment immediately. What they did is they put me on one-day employment as a one-day employee, and then I was no longer a repeat of the temporary employment, and then they put me on a new start for temporary employment until that period ran out, and did the same thing over again. Put me on one day as a daily employment, then back on new. That's the way they carried me until I became a United States citizen. And then I was put on city employment by the city health department. Never lost a day nor an hour of employment.
Okay. You became a citizen in 1955, right?
And?
You became a citizen in 1955, wasn't it?
Yeah, I became a citizen. You had to wait it was required that I wait five years. I had to live 5 years residence before you could even be naturalized. I became naturalized at the end of the time, and that was all right. No trouble with the naturalization. That's how it was. Huh. Pretty strange things happened, you see. But all this time, while I was working with the state, I went throughout the whole state of Minnesota and did a lot of work investigating various plants and hazards throughout the state. Well, then, when I transferred to the city of Minneapolis, I did the same thing within the city, so that I became very familiar with all the manufacturing plants in the state of, in the city of Minneapolis, and I think I had been into every one of them about 2.5 times before I got into other work. So you see, here's where I got a lot of experience. And a lot of these things are written up in my autobiography.
Right.
And I began writing articles for publication. And there was no restrictions on publications in the United States. So I got things published very, very well. And even before I came into the United States, I had permission to publish some things in Canada. And they were published in the Canadian Medical Journal. So I had several papers published there even before I came into the United States. And then with lecturing, I lectured at the university. I was invited to give lectures all over the state of Minnesota, here and there to various organizations where I gave lectures and talks for an awful lot of different groups. So my autobiography does tell of all the speeches I made and where I made them and what the subject was, and a lot of things that I needed for internal work among the people I worked with. I wrote other papers and things that were not published, but they were internal things and they were quite useful to the people I worked with. So I became quite well known, and my work was so extensive and my publication so extensive that I became a member of the National Organization for Industrial Medicine, the whole of the United States. Mm-hmm. I became a member. And then at one time that I went down to a national meeting, which was, I think it was in Buffalo, New York. While I was at the meeting there, I was surprised they called my name to come up to the front, and they brought me up to the platform at the front along with 4 or 5 other people, and they made me a fellow of the Industrial Medical Association for the whole of the United States, which is an honor that they could bestow on people that they felt should have it. But I had no inkling about it beforehand. I had nothing to do with it, just got that reputation. And then it was a little while after that, perhaps several months after that, that department of, I forget what they call it, the Preventive Medicine, that was a medical organization for preventive medicine, which they gave certification for people who were specialists, doctors who were specialists in aviation. And just about this time, they decided that they were going to provide specialization for doctors in occupational medicine. And my reputation was such that they invited me to become one of the founders of the organization and made me a certified member without an examination. So that's another thing that happened I had nothing to do with, just automatically developed. And then another few months later, there was a strictly medical organization that made fellows, selected certain people who were a distinction in a special field, and they made me a fellow of the American College of Preventive Medicine. Just as if, just like other people that get fellow with him in medicine or surgery. And the being a fellow is a distinction among the certified field in addition to certification. A lot of people are certified, but they're not fellows. So I was made a fellow automatically without knowing it was going to happen. So those are the That's things nice. That happened to me in occupational medicine.
And all these developments occurred after you were 49 or 50 years old when you moved to this country.
Yeah.
Although, of course, you got started to get into that, what, in 1942 when you first got into, was that considered industrial medicine or its precursor when you went to the Ajax plant?
This was it developed into industrial medicine, and they had nobody there that knew what to do for this problem of poisoning, TND poisoning, and they thought for some reason, I don't know how they chose me, there were five doctors there and a lot of them had been there before I was, but after I'd been there a few months they said they picked me to do it.
How did you happen to give up general practice to go to the Whitby?
Well, it was to this point, I felt that I was not doing a good enough job, that I was not as good as I was prepared to do, because after all, I graduated with honors in medicine and surgery from the University of Toronto, and they were only I think it was only five people that ever did that in my class, and I was one of those. And I set up a laboratory in Brownsville, and I did my own laboratory work, so I was found myself gradually trying and feeling a way into being a better man than a general practice. Mm-hmm. And I just got the feeling that something was impelling me to move out of general practice into a new field. Now, for your interest, this book points it out. When I was in the Toronto General Hospital as an intern, I had a severe attack of rheumatic fever, and I nearly died. And it was just a question whether I was going to survive or not. And they took my tonsils out and did everything they could think of to help me. And it didn't look at all promising. But all through my life, I had been a committed Christian. All through my childhood days after I was in middle of high school when I committed myself. And even in the university days, I did a lot of work in the spiritual field, worked with people in the university who were similarly minded. So that at this time when I became so ill, I committed myself to God, saying, I'll do whatever you do, whatever you want me to do. originally wanted to go be a foreign missionary, but I knew from my illness I never could survive if I went into a foreign country. So I'm, in other words, I committed myself to do whatever I was told to do. So when it came to moving from general practice into industrial medicine, something made me do it, and I couldn't tell you why. But that's when I changed into going to Ajax. That's how I got there.
Well, when you set up this laboratory, was that in the house in Brownsville?
In the basement.
In the basement?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What sort of tests did you do in the laboratory there?
Well, most of my work was under the microscope in looking at blood smears and things like that. You know, I made a diagnosis of a leukemia in a patient of mine just from the blood smear, and I communicated with the University of Toronto as to what I could do to treat him. At that time they told me there was nothing. They didn't know how to do anything. So he died. And things like this happened. In another situation in which I had a patient who had pernicious anemia, and I made the diagnosis on him from my own laboratory work. I knew he had pernicious anemia, which just showed up in a blood smear again. And the funny thing about this fellow, this man who had pernicious anemia and was under my care, he developed lobar pneumonia. He was critically ill, and I went to see him when he appeared to be dying. And he was a Roman Catholic, and the Roman priest and nurse were there, and they had just given him the last rites, and he was apparently conscious enough to understand what they were doing and what they said. And part of the ceremony is that as a representative, the priest would say, as God's representative or something, that your sins are forgiven. That's part of the last rites of the Catholic Church. And he was obviously dying when I was there, and I went out and talked to the priest and was talking to them. They were still there. And I told them he was dying. And I was just went back to take another look at him. And when I got back there, he was breathing normally. Now, I didn't do anything to, I hadn't even given him any treatment. I just simply observed a dying man and came back and talked to the priest and the people there and went back in. He was living again. Now, you could almost say this is a miracle, but...
Did he recover then?
Yes. He recovered, and I don't claim that I had anything to do with it, and I don't know that the priest had anything to do with it, but it's typical of lobar pneumonia. They either die or they recover, and this thing happens every once in a while. They have a dramatic change, and for the better, and I happened to be there at that time. So, well, that's one of the things that happened.
At what stage did you marry your first wife? Was that in while you were in medical school or just afterwards?
We were married at the end of the summer when I was about to go into my last year of schooling. And by that time, I had... earned enough money that I could afford to stop and get married and had enough money to carry me through my internship the next year. That's quite a story too. I was the only...
Pots and pans, doesn't it?
Pardon?
That has to do with pots and pans, doesn't it?
Yeah. You see, in university for my first year, I got by on $300 that was borrowed from my grandfather. and my father gave me $300. And that was all I needed to carry me through the first year, pretty tough scrimping, and I got through the first year. But nobody was ready to help me at Tin Can at the end of the first year. But I got a job selling aluminum, and I started in to sell this aluminum. And at the end of the first week, I had sold one 75-cent piece of, that's all that I've ever done. Didn't look very hopeful. And the end of the first month of selling wherever aluminum, I just broke even for my expenses, and I hadn't saved a thing. And then from then on, I began to pick up. Of course, we had instruction as to how to sell, but following his instruction didn't help much. But I think my own experience, I learned as I went along. So that by the end of the first summer, I had enough money to save to carry me through the next year of education without working during school hours, or didn't work a thing until the next vacation days. See, the vacation was 14 weeks, long stretch. And the next year I sold more and made better the next year than I had before.
Did selling pots and pans have anything to do with meeting Lila?
No.
How did you meet her?
Well, she was a girl I knew in Fairground, that only lived 3 miles away.
Oh.
So
you knew her while you were working those 3 years back on the farm?
Oh, yes.
Did you see a lot of her then?
Oh, quite a bit, yes. And I used to see her when I go home for a little time and all. And that's when, so as I say, we were married at the end of my fifth summer of selling. So that I quit 2 weeks before the 14 weeks were up, you see, and got married. And then I still had enough money. Now it happened the summer before, I was the best salesman they had for the whole of Canada. And they gave me $100 prize the year before for being the best man among all our salesmen. And when I quit at the end of 12 weeks instead of working the rest of the time, I was still way ahead. If I'd have kept on, I'd have got the prize again. But the other fellow came along, worked 2 weeks more, and he caught up a little more than what I'd sold. So he got the $100 prize, and I got a $50 prize.
For being second best.
For being second best. But he worked 14 weeks, and I worked only 12. I was still a better salesman, but I cut short.
Right. Did Uncle Clifford also sell wherever aluminum?
Yes, he did. And he was did fairly well. As a matter of fact, I think the year where I was first, I think he was fifth or something like that. Uh-huh. Of course, that was a long way down from being the first, the number of points. But he continued there.
How many summers did he sell wherever aluminum?
I don't know. I guess maybe he was only selling for, maybe it was only 1 year, but 2 years, maybe 2 years, I don't know. Well then, you see, I got many things involved. That was on the university years. Now I have a whole chapter on my university years in this, and my other activities.
How long was your internship after you finished the university?
It was a 1 year university in General Hospital.
And that's when you came down with rheumatic fever?
That's right.
So Lila was nursing you. You were married at that time, and she was taking care of you?
No, she had a job working for Timothy Eaton's company all the time that she was in Minneapolis.
So she was where?
In
Toronto?
Yes, in Toronto. And she was working for this Timothy Eaton company. Mm-hmm. so she didn't have to look after me. Now, when I was in, took sick, I was hospitalized free of charge in the general hospital, kept there for a long time, several weeks, with nursing attendants and doctor attendants, didn't cost me a thing.
And then you went back to Fairground to complete your recuperation?
Yes. And in order to get to Fairground, I had to go on a lying down on a stretcher, and the ambulance took me to the railroad station, and I was put in a freight car, empty freight car, on a stretcher, and somebody sitting there to be with me or back and forth. And I rode that way all the way to Tillsonburg. And then there was an ambulance there ready to meet me, and they took me off the train on the stretcher and into the ambulance, took me on the ambulance all the way down to Fairground, mm-hmm. where the bed was ready for me to be outside of a tent that they had set up on the lawn.
Was that to avoid contagion of anybody else, that you were outside?
No, it was a nice warm summer, and that was summer days that I could sleep out there day and night.
It was more comfortable to be outside?
Oh, yeah, quite comfortable. And they had wheels under the bed that they had there, wheels at one end and something like a wheelbarrow handles at the other end, and they could run me out in the sunshine and lie in the sun and run me back in there as for...
Back in the tent?
For the night. Uh-huh. And if I need to be in the shade or anything like that. So I was several weeks there outside until it was getting cold weather.
Was Lila there during the summer, or was she still working in Toronto?
She quit in Toronto and came home with me. And she was helping my mother in the house all the time, and she was looking after me while I was down there, waiting on me. And
Uncle Clifford gave me some pictures, including a couple showing you lying in your cot with the family all gathered around.
Well, that was when I was still out there on the cot. But when it got cold weather, I was not well enough to climb the stairs. I had to be put to bed upstairs. And my father picked me up in his arms and carried me up that narrow stair, all the way up the stairs, and put me to bed. So he was pretty strong.
So how much longer did your recuperation take?
Well, I guess I was about 8 months from the time I went home. So that was about 11 months from the time I took sick in the hospital before I was up around and beginning to get ready to go to work. So that's a long time to recover from rheumatic fever, but I made a complete recovery sufficiently that I was able to go to work, and I continued to have a certain amount of heart trouble, which I've always had. Still have the irregular sounds and things that are wrong with it. But
did you go directly then from Fairground to Brownsville, or did you have an intervening job?
Well, I started first of all to work on a salary for Dr. Alexander in Tillsburg. His partner had died, and he was all alone. And I think he might have indicated, might have been in a position to take me on as a partner, but he took me on as, on salary to start with. And then he wanted me to learn how to use the refraction stuff, how to test glasses, or take fit glasses on people with refraction. So he sent me to Toronto, and I was there about a couple of months at his expense to learn how to do refractions, fit glasses with an optometrist.
That wasn't something you learned in medical school.
No, this was a postgraduate education that he paid for. Well, so I was lucky again to have something given to me. Yeah. And so I learned to do that. Then when I went back there, by the time I got through, Dr. McLeod, who had the practice in Brownsville, had bought himself a partnership with Dr. Dr. Alexander. So that fixed it so I couldn't be a partner. But this happened while I was away in Toronto. So when I got back, he was the partner. And then the two together hired me to step in where Dr. McLeod had vacated and carry on the practice there. And I was paid a salary by the two of them to work there.
In Brownsville.
And after some months, I bought the salary. I bought the practice myself and had it as a private practice until I went away from there.
So you took over the doctor's house in Brownsville.
That's right. Bought the house from him.
Uh-huh. Did you live in Tilsonburg for 2 months while you were studying there with Lila?
She was, at that time, she was staying at her own home with her parents while I was away to getting this education in Toronto, you see, and then starting to work there. And for a while I boarded in Tilsonburg and worked with Dr. Alexander for a while. But after I went to Brownsville, of course she joined me.
That was the first time that you'd lived together in Brownsville, or?
Well, we lived together in Fairground before I was.
Oh, did she live in your parents' house then?
Oh, yeah.
I see. She was there nursing him.
Did you have a home together in Toronto?
An apartment? Yes, we had a room together in the same house where she lived with me in the room. And we rented the place together, and she worked downtown, and I worked at, I went to school.
So your home at that time was a rented room?
That's right.
And then when Betty was born, that was when you were in Brownsville?
That's right. That was quite a number of years later. And Douglas was born in Brownsville, too.
Were they born in the house, or were they born in the hospital?
They were both born in a hospital in London, both of them. But when you fellows came along, you were all born in the house.
No, James and I.
Except Warren.
He was born in Pembroke.
He was born in Pembroke.
Why was that?
Yeah.
What?
Why was it that we were born in the house instead of being taken to the hospital in London?
Well, I guess because I had been established and it seemed as if there wouldn't be so much trouble with your mother, and there wasn't any trouble at all. And Dr. Alexander attended in the house, in the home there. Everything went along well.
Was that our mother's preference to have the birth at home?
Well, I forget. A lot of people are having their babies at home. I had a big obstetrical crisis. I looked after a lot of people that carried their. There are only a few, maybe 4 or 5 of my 100 or so that ever were attended in the hospital. They were attended. I attended them at home. Mm-hmm. Had no trouble.
So that was the tradition those days.
Different situation.
So you were there at the birth, along with Dr. Alexander, for James and I.
Oh yeah, sure.
Were they both easy, relatively easy labors?
Oh yeah, not particularly difficult.
Do you remember at all how long?
Just the normal time that I wouldn't have known.
That's all right.
Well then, after. Where did I leave off? We were back, we've gone back a bit.
No? Yeah, we've been backing up. We're running out of tape, too.
I wanted to ask something about Minneapolis.
Well, I guess that's about enough for this, isn't it?
Well, let me just ask you one other thing. We were talking about occupational medicine or industrial medicine after you came to Minneapolis. Do you remember one or two or three of the worst situations that you came across in Minnesota or in Minneapolis where the health of the workers was in danger in some way or another? Do you remember situations like that were pretty dramatic?
The lead poisoning?
I think perhaps I better not go into an industry particularly, but there was one place where it seemed to me when I visited there that the symptoms that people have was carbon monoxide poisoning. And quite a number of the people were having trouble. And the peculiar feature about the heating plant in this place was they had open gas flames up near the ceiling, and you could see the gas flame up there, and several of them had white flame instead of a blue flame, and it looked to me as if this was giving off carbon monoxide. Well, then we had our instruments and we found the carbon monoxide coming from these ones that were not properly adjusted. They had yellow.
This has been a copy of an interview recorded at Warren's house on April 26, 1984.